The dark side.
Are you ready to go to the dark side? With all this talk of attacking this and breaching that, you must have anticipated there was a shadier side to the internet. Turns out, that's true. One of the fascinating things about this underground network of connectedness is that most people have absolutely no idea it even exists. Meanwhile, hackers are hiding in its many virtual cracks and crevices as they craft their next exploit. With a challenge this great, it might be wise to remember the old adage about knowing the enemy and start learning as much as possible about all the things we do not see. Welcome to Tor. Everyone is a product of their environment, or so we've been told. If this is true, where do hackers come from? And considering how much they love the internet, where do they hang out in cyberspace? Of course, it would be silly to assume all hackers are exactly the same, with all the same objectives and interests. However, it's safe to say they all likely know a fair amount about the underbelly of the internet. And if you hope to have a full understanding of cybersecurity and the dangers of the online world, you will need to as well. Because whether the majority of today's internet users realize it or not, the digital landscape we face now can be far more perilous than most people would ever suspect. Tor. The internet has a secret it doesn't want you to know. Despite what most people believe, the World Wide Web is not the only game in town. Free software like Tor offers users access to an open network that exists outside, or rather on top of, the World Wide Web. Tor provides an overlay network to the existing internet, giving global online traffic a way to remain anonymous and undetectable. As an internet browser, Tor aims to protect the user by separating identification and routing and randomly bouncing communications through from hub to hub. Because it works at the application level, Tor has a level of independence that sets it apart from most other anonymity networks. The encryption is applied in layers, like an onion, and each node peels off overlapping code as it passes through the network. This notion of layers is prevalent in cybersecurity because it does a great job of explaining how different protective measures work together. Tor makes it almost impossible to trace a person's internet activity, thus providing increased privacy and confidentiality, and, as a result, has essentially created a dark corner of cyberspace where all purposes and intents can find expression. Paired with a VPN, Tor provides anonymity for the user whose data is encrypted and cannot be monitored by an external observer, not something found on the regular internet, otherwise known as the ClearNet. So, if a user's movement is tracked, the only visible transmission will be going into or coming out of a Tor node, nothing more. The areas of the internet discussed below can only be accessed through Tor. The secret internet. Despite the large number of people using the internet, there's only a small part of the internet we can actually see. According to experts, only 4% of the online information stored on the internet is actually accessible through search engines serving the general public. Think about that for a moment. That means approximately 96% of the World Wide Web is essentially invisible to the regular person. The Deep Web. There are two parts of this unexplored online information: the Deep Web and the Dark Net. Any data that lives in the Deep Web cannot be found through a standard search engine. It's not like the surface web, where all the ready-to-find information you could possibly want is right at your fingertips. The deep web stores the personal information we would like to keep private, like online banking, on-demand video, and other paid services. The dark net. The underground computer network known as the dark net is a virtual realm with restricted access where users can access what's on the internet, and a whole lot more. Through the use of Tor's overlay network, the dark net can be accessed with specific software, configurations, and/or authorization that makes the user anonymous, often using unusual communication protocols and ports. Within the darknet, special privacy networks have been set up to allow for untraceable file sharing and peer-to-peer communication that can be achieved without the use of a centralized administrative system. In other words, this cover of internet darkness allows users to operate without being observed by governments, the authorities, whistleblowers, or basically anyone. That said, malicious actors on the darknet have ways of identifying other network users if they do not protect themselves with the added encryption of a VPN. Since user identity is virtually untraceable on the darknet, you can imagine it is consequently filled with all sorts of highly illegal activities and marketplaces, and a whole lot of hackers, making it a risky environment for anyone just wandering the network. But the darknet contains more than just ne'er-do-wells. Other privacy-minded people and government agencies use it as well. Whistleblowers and human rights activists often use the darknet to pass along information, especially in countries where censorship and oversight can be crippling. You might be surprised to learn that Tor was originally created by U.S. Naval Laboratory researchers who needed to find ways to communicate freely without fear of detection. But it's unlikely they ever anticipated the darknet would evolve into the shady rabbit hole it has become. Encrypted messaging. Have you started to wonder how all of these hackers are able to communicate without detection, purchase illegal goods on the darknet, and communicate without exposing any of their own personal information? Encryption, of course. As you recall, this method of coding text to appear indecipherable is one of the best and baddest tricks in the cybersecurity bag. To send an encrypted message, the sending device must first generate a random encryption key that can only be used once for that specific message. It will then encipher the contents of that communication, otherwise known as the payload, using that specially coded key. The device will do this by taking the recipient's public key, which it has gleaned through the Web of Trust authentication process, and attaching a newly encrypted one in its place before sending off the payload. In this way, the message is now carrying an anonymous, encoded header that allows it to move undetected through the network. The whole communication, both the data and encrypted key, are then sent to the receiving device, where they are decoded using a reverse of the same process. Of course, when the message first arrives at its destination, the encryption keeps it from being read. So, the device must detach the coded key from the payload, decrypt the key using its own private one, and then decipher the communication using the newly minted key. Just think about how different levels of security work together, and it makes sense. The message stays locked up tight, but the key goes through a transformation on the receiving end, so it can be used as a deciphering tool. Devices on both ends will always have the same public and private keys. These never change between messages. The only key that changes is the randomly generated one produced by the sending device. It is a disposable key created for one-time use, thrown away once the message is decrypted. This enhances its security considerably, and when the receiving device wants to return the message and become the sender, it employs precisely the same process. In this way, both sides are continually making special, top-secret keys to be used and then destroyed, so no trail of evidence is left behind. That said, most encrypted email services provide one level of security, as they encode only the messages being sent. However, the communication channels through which they are traveling are not secure, as their data is still being presented in clear text and can be easily monitored and manipulated. By employing a VPN, however, a user can add another layer of encryption to the process through the encoding of their personal IP address. That way, when a subscriber in San Francisco uses a VPN to go online, their cyber identity is hidden and may appear to be coming from Vancouver, Tel Aviv, Cape Town, or any number of global gateway cities. This additional security measure is an easy and affordable way to maximize the privacy of your communications. Third-party privacy protection. Here's a bit of good news. Privacy is not just for hackers anymore. You too can enjoy an increased level of anonymity and security online by making a few small changes in the way you move around the internet. Of course, establishing your own VPN will make a big difference, as will using encrypted email. But you must also understand more about the inherent risks of accepting your privacy through third-party vendors. Not all providers of VPNs and encrypted messaging services are ethical, so you will need to maneuver through the world of privacy with caution, knowledge, and a sense of what you want. Even if the application is basically secure, poor or irresponsible stewardship of your information can lead to breaches in the increased security you are trying to foster. Here are some common questions to consider. Should your data be stored on a local PC or on a third-party system? For some privacy-minded users, storing their information with a third party sounds like a questionable idea, but there are some benefits to using a cloud-based system. First, it's arguably safer than using a local storage-only application, mostly because email providers have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars into security systems capable of warding off most advanced malware and brute force attacks. Reversely, finding this level of protection for a PC can be wildly expensive. Accessing your saved emails on a secure cloud service is extremely difficult for an attacker, whereas gaining access to your personal device and your data is far easier.
Did you know? In the past several years, it is estimated that 96% of American companies have used cloud-based systems in some way. The majority of those companies are using multiple clouds. The future is definitely trending towards the cloud.
Should you use a free or paid email service? While choosing a free service might seem like a no-brainer, there are certain drawbacks to be aware of. When you utilize free email encryption, you are entrusting your private information to a company who may, in turn, sell it for targeted marketing or place invasive ads in their software. After all, they have to make money somehow. So, when you pay for a service, you are likely satisfying that financial demand for a vendor who will then guard your information accordingly. In fact, the argument could be made that paying a vendor for their solution assures their dedication to your privacy. Otherwise, they will quickly find themselves out of business. What else should I know about my email provider? When choosing a vendor, consider the location of its headquarters and data centers. Even if the provider is dedicated to protecting your data through solid business practices, lenient or unethical laws in the country where they house their services can put your information at risk. Many governments will take advantage of information sharing agreements and surveillance laws that allow them to seize information and share it with whomever they like and for any reason. If this happens, the email provider has no choice other than to comply with the demand and turn over their records, thereby relinquishing access to whatever user information they have. This not only breaches the security of your account, but it places your private information in the hands of a questionable government agency. But despite these shortcomings, encrypted email is still an effective way to protect your online privacy and keep your information away from hackers and government spies. With a proper understanding of the technology's strengths, weaknesses, and overall framework, you can find confidence in the service and a real way to regain your power as a safe and anonymous citizen. Tricks of the dark trade. As we know, there are a lot of different hackers in the world. Some work for good, some not so much. But at the end of the day, they all tend to rely on the same bag of tricks. Yes, their forms of manipulation and social engineering are always evolving, but it is possible to nail down several of their key attack vectors if you know where to look. Password attacks. While we know hash functions are used to encode private messages, they can also be used as tools to craft certain types of exploits. A cryptographic hash function allows for the use of a mathematical algorithm to encrypt data, which makes it an essential component to one-way functions and passwords. A brute force attack happens when a hacker uses a computer program to systematically run through a list of potential passwords until it can log in. This type of attack works especially well with PIN numbers because an algorithm can be set to run through all the different possible number combinations for the number of required digits. In this way, they are using their brute strength to gain access, trying a lot of different password options again and again and again and again to see if they can locate the correct combination, almost like battering on a locked door. So, if the password is simple, it will likely be breached pretty quickly. Attackers get these passwords from a variety of tables and databases, like the well-known Rainbow Table, which is a table with a huge set of pre-computed hash function inputs and corresponding outputs. A Rainbow Table removes the computational part of a brute force attack because it has already performed all the hash function work. With all the hash function values in the table, the job now becomes searching and comparing to see if there is a password match. A dictionary attack occurs when a hacker tries to log in by using a computer program to run through lists of common words. This threat is subtle because it only tries those possibilities which are likely to succeed. This type of attack often works because people tend to choose passwords that are less than 7 characters and can function as single words like those in the dictionary. A keylogger attack is a bit more sophisticated because it uses a program to track a user's keystrokes. This allows the hacker to see everything the user has typed on the keyboard, including those private passwords and codes. This is different from the other two types of attacks in several ways. Not only does a keylogging attack first have to cleverly install malware on the target's computer by enticing them to download something, it also has the ability to breach even the most super secret passwords. It is almost flawless. Generating a table of the hashes of all the words in English is relatively fast for a computer algorithm to do. Adding in all the combinations of letters, numbers, and a few punctuation marks to make 8 characters takes a lot longer, but can still be done, especially with our much faster computer systems. All the hacker has to do with a rainbow table is compare it to a list of hashes that they retrieved from a company website or server, and if any hashes match, voila, they've just encrypted a bunch of personal data. Birthday paradox. In their quest for access, hackers have mathematical probability on their side. This probability is called the birthday paradox, and it allows them to be fairly sure of the number of potential values they have to check in a table until they come up with a match. The birthday paradox states that if you're at a party with a group of people, in order for there to be a 50% chance that any two people in the room share the same birthday, you only need 23 people at the party. How is that possible if there are 365 days in a year? Think about the idea in terms of matches and pairs. You aren't just trying to match one specific person with anyone else's birthday. Anyone's birthday might match with anyone else's. In order to find out if you have a match, you would check if anyone has your birthday, asking the other 22 people if they match yours. And then the next person asks everyone except you if they have their birthday, which is 21 comparisons, and so on. If you total up all those birthday comparisons, you will have made 253 comparisons by the end of the night, which creates a high probability that someone's going to share a birthday. It would be even weirder that after 253 comparisons, no one shared a birthday, right? The birthday attack is a function that allows hackers to work out just how many options they need in a set to find a match. And in this part of computer science where encryption and hashing are involved, a match is called a collision. A collision refers to a situation where two different inputs have the same output. As we know, hash functions convert any input message into a long string of numbers and letters that then create a cryptographic fingerprint for that message. And like fingerprints, the resulting hashes are useful as long as they're unique. If two different message inputs generate the same hash, they collide, and this collision is where a hacker can gain entry into a system. For example, once a hacker has discovered a collision, perhaps in the transmission of encrypted documents, they can perform a man-in-the-middle attack, where they replace the original message with one of their own that has some kind of malicious intent, but because their message still creates the same hash, the receiver thinks they are still getting the same encrypted, certified message from the original sender. To protect from rainbow table attacks and other brute force techniques, passwords are often salted after they are hashed. Salt is a bit of randomized data inserted into a password so that the password is more likely to create a unique hash. Because we are human and tend to use words or memorable combinations repeatedly when making passwords, we run up against the likelihood that what is memorable to us is also memorable to many others. In other words, our unique password may not be as unique as we think, especially when it is referenced outside of our username. Salting the password brings back the uniqueness, just like table salt brings back flavor. A randomly generated bit of information is added to the password through the use of an algorithm. And then, your hash is your own salty hash, free from the influence of a rainbow attack. Backdoor attacks. Applications that allow for remote access to computers are particularly susceptible to backdoor attacks because they enable hackers to leverage undiscovered or secret methods with the goal of bypassing normal authentication systems. Although these security holes are typically the second or even third point of entry, backdoors let hackers sneak past any kind of intrusion detection system, gain control of a target network, and abuse it without anyone being the wiser. This move would allow a hacker to then do any number of things, including spread more malware, scurry off with sensitive data, or launch a distributed DOS attack, DDoS, which means the attack is coming from many different sources at once. Even though sealing up backdoors seems like a no-brainer, it's not always that simple. Sometimes these secret access points are built into the code of a website developer who created it to make maneuvering their own system easier. But this convenience can come at a steep price if it becomes detectable by hackers. Tools for finding security holes. We know hackers are out there just looking for ways to break in, but just how easy is it? The answer is a little spookier than you may realize. When the average user jumps online, they only see part of what's really there. They follow the prompts and well-lit paths designed to guide them around safely, but what they don't see are the many camouflaged tunnels and pockets visible only to those with tech-savvy skills, like hackers. Even though many of these secret doors and wormholes are well hidden by the efforts of cybersecurity, malicious attackers are still able to find hidden vulnerabilities within these seemingly secure computer systems because they know how to look for a security hole. Also known as a vulnerability, this is a system flaw that allows someone like a hacker to gain illegal entry into some level of the system. Many of the scripts, tools, and applications used by hackers are open source, free, and easy to find on the internet. Once they have them, attackers can just adapt them to meet their own needs, whatever they may be. So, how exactly do hackers find these hidden vulnerabilities? Here are some more of the most common vulnerability assessment tools used in the hacking trade. Scanner. A scanner is a device for examining, reading, or monitoring something. With regards to cybersecurity, programs like port scanners can be used to accomplish a variety of goals, both good and bad. It just depends on what you are looking to monitor and why. They can test and troubleshoot a network for those looking to strengthen a system, probe a server or host for open ports, or verify security policies. Some other vulnerability scanners are used to find loopholes in security or network flaws. Packet sniffer. A packet sniffer, also known as a network sniffer, captures and often analyzes network traffic so all packets can be inspected further. Initially introduced in 1988, this device was among the first that allowed users to sit comfortably at their desk while still keeping an eye on the larger network. These original sniffers can decipher the headers of data packet payloads coming through the network and provide all sorts of information on their size, origin, and intended destination. While packet sniffers can help network managers predict and solve problems, they can also provide a hacker with a lot of useful information about user traffic.
Metasploit Project. The Metasploit Project is a computer security project that provides information about vulnerabilities and can be used by ethical hackers as well as black hats. Metasploit code can be used to exploit systems, but it can also be used to help uncover weaknesses and protect computer systems.
Custom tools. Used by sophisticated hackers, custom tools are designed for specific targets and are nearly impossible to detect. Hackers use software, data, or special commands in the form of code to attack these security holes and gain control over a computer system, access private information, create a denial of service situation, or some other similarly styled attack. Depending on the exploit, hackers use software, data chunks, or sequenced commands to take advantage of a bug or security hole and tamper with a computerized system. They are designed for personal gain or to purposely invade an online space. When they're feeling secretive, hackers may keep the discovery of a security hole to themselves, and when they're feeling generous, they might just share it with the larger hacking world.
Click to reveal the names of some popular exploit kits, a collection of exploits. MPAC, Phoenix, Black Hole, Magnitude, Nuclear, CrimePAC.
Phases of attack. As we already know, when a vulnerability is exposed in some way, the owner of the system uses a patch to seal up the weakness and avoid the threat. Imagine a wall holding back a large amount of water, and every time someone puts a crack in that wall, water seeps through, or, in some cases, gushes out. This escaping water is like data leaking out of a computer for hackers to steal and store away. The owner of the cracked wall, or breached system, must then find a way to patch that wall to prevent any more precious water, or data, from escaping. System users usually download patch applications from the web as soon as they realize there is a security problem. If they don't, a larger security breach is a likely outcome, just like extra pressure behind a cracked wall will probably cause a bigger gap to form. The time from when a security hole is found or exploited to when it is fully patched is called the window of vulnerability. The size of this window, or overall time frame, directly relates to the amount of damage a hacker can do. More time equals more harm. These exploits can be classified in different ways, the most common being how they interact with a vulnerability. A local exploit requires prior access to the system, so it's usually performed by a hacker who has privileged information or existing access. This trick usually allows the hacker to then gain even more privilege and therefore move past any security boundaries. A remote exploit connects to the machine through an off-site network by taking advantages of bugs or weaknesses in the system. A zero-day exploit is an attack facilitated by an undiscovered flaw in computer software that can be exploited quickly before the user has a chance to apply a patch. If a hacker finds a way to publish an exploit without the system user noticing, there are 0 days in which to create a patch or fend off the threat. Say a system administrator uses their work account to surf the internet during lunch, and they are victimized by infected malware, which puts the entire work network at risk. Even though they meant no intentional harm, they are the vulnerability, not the technology. The bottom line is, despite our advanced skills, we are still only human. And we make mistakes, sometimes big ones, which create opportunities for attackers. So the best thing we can do is to educate ourselves about the common mistakes people make online and how we, as users, can prevent our own networks from being exploited. No one is perfect, and neither is the software they create. There will always be bugs and imperfections, even when they appear to be working exactly as planned. Developers and testers use automated tools to locate vulnerabilities in code, but they are never able to find them all, especially on a large-scale project. So, they continue to build more and more patches and functionality into the software, making it stronger and more complex. But this complicated code can also make weaknesses harder to find. A real vulnerability in the code, where a hacker can reach through a security hole and grab the valuables, is incredibly subtle and hard to detect. And they can be instantly created through one wrong keystroke or one missing text directive in the form of a dash, colon, or asterisk. Reconnaissance. If you have ever watched a war movie or read a military book, you're going to recognize some of this upcoming language, maybe because being a successful hacker is a bit like being a soldier. Before going into online battle, it's important to do good reconnaissance. A military term for observing enemy territory to identify all of its features, physical and otherwise, before launching an attack. Once a soldier understands the inner workings of their target, it's easier to plan an effective assault. Hackers do reconnaissance when they stealthily enter a computer system to check it out and gain knowledge about how to exploit it. Reconnaissance, also known as footprinting, requires patience, thought, and a lot of skill. In the case of the military, a soldier spying on an enemy camp might look for routine things, like sleep patterns and weapon storage, to determine the best method of attack. In cyberspace, a hacker might get to know a target system by identifying the operating system, uncovering details about how data is passed along, port scanning, and mapping the network. An ethical hacker might use it to find vulnerabilities they would like to patch up. This process of information gathering is known as passive reconnaissance, or a passive attack, because they are just seeking information rather than actively exploiting the target, like an active attack. Regardless, a passive attack is one of the most effective ways for hackers to identify hidden weak points and assess how they can best penetrate them. As a result, any countermeasure crafted to confront such an attack must focus on the integrated use of information-related capabilities to disrupt, deny, degrade, destroy, or deceive an online adversary. Anatomy of a cyber attack. Along with reconnaissance, there are a number of applications available to help hackers scan different systems for vulnerabilities. By using these tools to enter specific code, different websites are basically scanned and their weaknesses displayed. Not good. So, let's step back a moment and take an aerial view of a cyber attack. It essentially has three phases to remember: reconnaissance, infiltration, and exfiltration. Reconnaissance allows an attacker to gather information through passive and active methods to identify where security penetration is possible, like how some traffic gets through the firewall, what hosts are on the network, and what services they have running. It looks like port 80 is running traffic. Let's go. Infiltration happens when a hacker stops watching and starts doing by gaining control of a host on the target's network, typically through the use of remote access. Just knowing a weakness is not enough to infiltrate a target. An attacker must find a way to take advantage of it as well. Exfiltration is the final phase of the attack, when hackers finally get their hands on the data they want and take it, and if they're skilled enough, backing quietly out of the exploit without leaving a trace. Because computers are excellent record keepers, always recording logging information, network connections, and errors received, exfiltration is not necessarily an easy feat. In fact, it's nearly impossible to eliminate all traces of an intrusion, so the goal is really to minimize them as much as possible.
Reconnaissance. Just like a soldier scouting out the enemy, cyber reconnaissance involves watching and identifying system weaknesses. Infiltration. Similar to a battle being launched, infiltration begins when a hacker uses a weakness to take control of a system. Exfiltration. The secret mission is complete once the hacker has found the data they wanted and have exited the system without leaving much of a trace.
Threatening networks and applications. No two cyber attacks are exactly alike. Still, there are many schemes hackers use repeatedly because they are proven to be effective. Remember, hackers in theory might sound spooky and devious, but in reality, they are really just people sitting behind a computer screen. And like most people, they tend to rely on certain methods and practices they like. Fortunately, for those looking to protect themselves online, these hacker calling cards can also be used to bolster the strength of a security system. Attack signatures. When in the midst of exploiting a system, hackers often leave behind a unique piece of information or an attack signature, sort of like a cyber fingerprint. An attack signature can be the use of certain channels, specially designed malware, or in the case of the notorious hacktivists Anonymous, a special message left behind letting everyone know who was there. As identifying rules or patterns, attack signatures identify classes of threats on a web application and its components. Some signatures are designed to protect specific OSs, web servers, and databases, or they can be defined by the user and stored in the attack signature pool along with the signatures supplied by the system. To establish an effective security policy, it is important to understand the differences between various attack signatures and how they can be viewed as calling cards for future threats. An effective online security system will put the attack signatures into staging, which means the system applies the signatures to the web application traffic. When signatures match certain attack patterns during the staging period, the system essentially learns from them, becoming stronger in the process, and will alert users to the danger. The following table offers a few examples of attack types and the unique features used to identify them. Authentication authorization targets a website's method of validating a user's identity, service, or application. These attacks try to muddle the authentication process and confuse the computer about whether or not to grant permission for access. Denial of service overwhelms the system's resources so it can no longer provide normal service to users. Detection evasion attempts to disguise or hide an attack to avoid detection by the security system. Abuse of functionality uses a website's own features and functionality to consume, defraud, or avoid the application's access control mechanisms. Trojan, backdoor, spyware tries to get around the web or application server's built-in security by masking the attack within a legitimate communication, like an email or document. Application attacks. Regardless of what applications are intended to do, it is still a viable target for hacking. There are certain features a malicious actor will look for when shopping for applications to threaten, as it makes them more prone to victimization. Just like houses with the lights off and no bars over the windows make better targets for robbers, applications that are popular, controversial, or even hated by the public can make for good hacking. And when a juicy target pops up on a hacker's radar, they have more than a few attack types to choose from. Here are some of the most well-known. Botnet. A botnet is not just one compromised computer, but a whole network of compromised computers under the control of a malicious actor. Each device in a botnet is called a bot, which is formed when a computer is infected by malware and third-party control is enabled, thus creating zombie computers who will do whatever they are told by an outsider. More bots can be recruited using viruses, worms, or other malware. Threats include email spam, DDoS attacks, and data theft. Rootkit. This is a computer program designed to provide privileged access to a computer while actively hiding in its presence. Once a rootkit is installed, the controller has the power to remotely execute files and alter system configuration on the host machine. Spoofing. When a malicious party impersonates another device or user in a network to launch an attack, they are using a spoofing approach. This might be done to steal data, spread malware, or bypass access controls, all of which will bring a hacker closer to their ultimate goal. Spyware. Even though the name sounds a bit melodramatic, spyware is a real software designed to install itself on your computer and quietly monitor everything you do online without your knowledge or consent. This malware then uses this vantage point to gather a user's private information, such as name, address, browsing habits, interests, preferences, and downloads. This data can then be relayed, i.e. sold, to other parties like hackers, or even marketing firms who use it as adware to increase overall revenue.
Knowledge check. Test your knowledge of new information by answering these questions and then review the feedback. Question 1. Lucas has been hacking for over 10 years. He gets his scripts and software exploits from a source that is completely private and untraceable. Which of the following is Lucas most likely using in order to obtain his hacking tools? WhatsApp. WhatsApp is a messaging app that allows users to send encrypted messages. It is not a platform that allows hackers to download hacking software. The Internet. While hackers can download exploits and hacking tools on the Internet, their actions might be traceable. Consider an option that allows for complete privacy and anonymity. Payload. Payload refers to the content of a message that is being sent. It is not a platform for downloading hacking software. Tor. Tor is a special browser that allows users to access the secret parts of the Internet, such as the deep web and the dark net, where hackers often find software tools for exploits. Question 2. Which of the following statements is false? A brute force attack is carried out by software that automatically tries various passwords until entry is gained. This is a true statement. A brute force attack is an automated attack, not a manual attack. The simpler a password is, the less time a brute force attack needs to crack the password. This is a true statement. A brute force attack can breach a simple password much quicker than a complex password. A rainbow table makes the job of a brute force attack harder because it removes all the hash function values. This is a false statement. A rainbow table makes the brute force attack easier because it stores the hash function inputs and outputs in the same table, so that all the attack software needs to do is look for a password match. The passwords used in a brute force attack usually come from tables and databases. This is a true statement. Brute force attacks usually get their passwords from various tables and databases, such as rainbow tables. Question 3. Patel is a hacker who has just gained illegal access to a system in another country. His goal is to steal classified information and sell it on the deep web. What type of attack has Patel just launched? Remote exploit. A remote exploit is an attack that happens from an off-site network rather than in person. Local exploit. A local exploit must involve prior access by the hacker, such as an employee or a manager. Since there was no mention of Patel having such access, it was most likely not a local exploit. Zero-day exploit. A zero-day exploit involves a flaw or bug in the system that the hacker exploits before a patch can be applied. Since there was no mention of Patel exploiting a flaw, there is a better option for the type of attack that Patel launched. Denial of service attack. A denial of service attack involves flooding a system's server, effectively taking it down so that users cannot access its resources. Question 4. What is the difference between spyware and spoofing? Spyware impersonates another device or user in order to gain access, while spoofing monitors all the actions on a system. The statement has the definitions switched. Spyware monitors the actions on a system, while spoofing impersonates a user or device. Spyware logs all of a user's actions on a system in order to gather private data, while spoofing acts like a trusted device or user in order to gain access to a system. Spyware is more concerned with spying on a user's actions, whereas spoofing impersonates a user or device. Spyware makes itself known immediately by causing numerous disruptions in the system, while spoofing remains quiet and usually undetected. The goal of both spyware and spoofing is to remain undetected. Spyware is more interested in spreading malware and destroying a system, while spoofing is more interested in gathering private data. Spyware is more interested in gathering private data, while spoofing might involve spreading malware or stealing data.
Conclusion. Real protection comes only through understanding everything about the landscape you hope to secure. And through increased learning, you also gain the skills to see a world of threats most people don't recognize. As a place, the internet is vast and complex, filled with every type of person you might see on Earth, all working with the technological tools they have to get ahead in this virtual world. And if today's issues around cybersecurity are any indication, the internet's evolution is also moving at breakneck speed. Are you ready to keep up?